Bruce Pratt joining us for this week's Sports Lit 101, a chance to talk with the gentleman who's been on with us before and to talk about one of our favorite baseball books, favorite sports books through the years. It's called Smokey Joe Wood, The Biography of a Baseball Legend. We're happy to welcome back author Gerald Wood. Gerald, thank you so much for being with us again.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Glad to join you.
Well, we love the book so much, and we have brought it up a number of times through the years. Every time we're talking about unique and interesting baseball stories, we often go back to Smokey Joe Wood because he was certainly one of a kind.
That's for sure. He certainly was. I think a lot of people have trouble evaluating him because his career was so different.
His early life was so different, too. I mean, that as a teenager, he could play baseball with grown-ups, if you will. And his father was a peripatetic fellow, to say the least, always on the move. He bounced around, did a lot of things. For him to end up being a baseball player in Boston, that was a really strange journey to get there.
That's for sure. I mean, he was actually born in Kansas City, and his family moved to Western Kansas. But really, when they were in a little town called Ouray, Colorado, which is really very near Telluride, is where he first really started playing baseball in an organized way. And as you mentioned, his father, I mean, one of the things that was determinative of his life was his father was gone quite a bit. He went to Alaska one time, and while they were in Ouray, he also went to California and to Arizona. So to a certain extent, Joe was orphaned, and baseball became, and the guys that he played baseball with became his kind of surrogate family. And so baseball was extremely important to him, not only because he was gifted and his older brother played, but because it really gave him a sense of order and a sense of family from a very young age.
It also has interesting ties to the area, what I call the other tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, up in the corner in the Delaware. And those family ties and his relationship to the Red Sox and his time spent in New Haven and other places, it seems that geography often played a real role in who he was.
That's for sure. You know, he was from, at least his family was from, a little town called Chihola, which is on the Delaware River, but only about 2 hours from New York City and not that far from Boston either. So even though he wasn't growing up a local kid, in a sense, he was coming home when he came back to Eastern Pennsylvania. And, you know, he was only 18 years old when he came up with the Red Sox. And so he had a real interesting connection to Boston, to Red Sox, and to the New England area, that's for sure.
One of the things that Bob Ryan always likes to point out is that in 1912, Smokey Joe Wood had the best season any Boston professional athlete ever had. And no disagreement on this end. Could you talk a little bit about him going 34-5 for the Red Sox?
Yeah, I'd love to, and I sure appreciate Bob keeping Smokey Joe's name alive. Every once in a while, I think Bob takes a little bit of heat for talking about Smokey Joe Wood, particularly because in that year of the World Series, he didn't do quite as well as he had done in during the year. But it was an amazing, amazing year. In fact, one of the things that I point out in the book is that there was a very strange game played on the 4th of July, in which uncharacteristically Wood made an error, and Speaker even made a mental mistake. He was on third base on a sacrifice fly. He didn't get back. He didn't score in time, and the guy was doubled off of first base. And Wood ended up losing that game. One of the reasons that's so significant is that that was the year that Joe Wood tied the consecutive win record of 16 with Walter Johnson. Wood had won 9 games before that game on the 4th of July, and afterwards he won the 16. So if he would have won that game, which he should have won, and Boston really sort of uncharacteristically fumbled that game away, he would have won 26 games in a row in that year. So it was an amazing year, even beyond the record that's still held. of 16 consecutive wins. And it was a very dramatic year, and it led to a very dramatic World Series as well. Wood was really, really on that year. There was some indication that he was going to be that good because the year before he had won 23 games. But he was still only 22 years old when he won 34 and lost five. And not only won 16 in a row, he also won nine in a row another time during that year. So he was their big pitcher that year at the young age of 22.
As you mentioned, he didn't pitch quite up to those standards in the 1912 World Series. And it was fascinating when I read it the first time and then when I went back to reread it this week to realize that he got wrapped up in some controversy, that there were certainly some suggestions that maybe he was part of a fix when he struggled early in the series.
Yeah, that's an interesting story, and I take that with a grain of salt. I mean, he did pitch really well early in that series, especially in the first game. He was almost miraculous. They had the tying run on third, the Giants did, and the lead run on, and it would have been the winning run on second base. And Wood struck out two guys in a row. And later he once said he didn't even think the guy on the last pitch on a 3-2 pitch probably even saw the pitch. And he was even stronger the second time. So he did pitch really well in the first two times out. But it's the third game that's the one that's so controversial that Wood basically just got beat up in the first inning, only threw 13 pitches in the whole game. And that ballooned his earned run average, you know, well over four when it actually had pitched really well. I think the controversy has to do with the people couldn't explain why that would happen. And so in trying to figure this out, you know, the suspicions were that maybe somebody, maybe even in Wood's family, had bet on that third time and when he was supposed to pitch, and the Red Sox lost. And so when he pitched the next day, that he would lose the game. He adamantly denied that. And there were no reasons, I think, for him to lie later. I mean, it makes nice copy to suggest that Wood might have thrown that game. But I really don't think so. I think that what's more likely is a strategic issue. And that is that Wood was really afraid. He had a little bit of a tendency to get wild, and he also had a fear of hitting batters. So you can see right at the end of the previous game, the Giants started swinging at the first pitch because they knew that Wood would try to get it over because he didn't want to walk anybody, and he certainly didn't want to hit anybody. In fact, he had hit one of the crises early in the series was when he hit Chief Myers, the catcher for the Giants. And the world sort of held its breath, or at least the Boston Red Sox fans held their breath, is what would Wood do? Would Wood fall apart, which he had done in one game before when he hit a guy. So he was really trying, I think, in that third game to get off to a good start. And the Giants basically hit the first pitch, and it only took 13 pitches for Wood to, to fall apart. And he also got kind of rattled. He went into a windup with men on base. Of course, he had a chance to redeem himself then in the final game, which became even more dramatic. But there certainly was a lot of controversy that even involved, to a certain extent, as Boston almost always does, religion. The idea being that O'Brien, being a Catholic, that Wood was angry at him, and that the Protestants were once again angry with the Catholics, and the Catholics were angry with the Protestants. One of the things in my book, I think that's probably overstated, and it's probably something that again made good press, but there really isn't any evidence to that. And what I argue in my book is that this is the evidence that Joe Wood didn't have any problems with Catholics. First of all, his wife was brought up a Catholic. His best friend was Tris Speaker, who married a Catholic. We all know that Ray Chapman was killed. He was by a pitch, and Wood was great friends with him. Was there when he got hit. Was a pallbearer in his funeral. And that was at the major mass in downtown Cleveland where Wood was a pallbearer. He was very close to Ray Chapman, who also was Catholic. So I think that probably was somewhat overstated, especially as suggesting, you know, that Wood would have tried to throw a baseball game to get back at O'Brien. That just seems to be an overextension to me. He certainly had a bad game, and that gave him a chance to somewhat redeem himself. The series as a whole is he really pitched pretty well, except in that one game. And in that one game, it was one inning and out. And but he did win three games, one of the few pitchers to win three games in the World Series. That made-up game, the eighth game, he was the winning pitcher.
We're talking with Gerald Wood about his book, Smokey Joe Wood, the biography of a baseball legend. His arch rival in that series, Christy Mathewson, was a guy that Smokey Joe Wood never got along with. What was the source of that friction in the relationship?
Well, it's related to what we were just talking about. That, you know, Christy Mathewson still has the reputation of being the Christian gentleman and being such a good guy. And he also was, to a certain extent, representative of the baseball players. And what Wood didn't like about Christy Mathewson was that he later brought up this issue of what had happened in the World Series of 1912. And Wood felt that both as a gentleman and as somebody representing the baseball players, that Mathewson shouldn't have brought up these old wounds, that he should have been more decorous about this and more sensitive to this. And so Wood never really got over that. I mean, he, for the rest of his life, really resented that Christy Mathewson repeated things that Wood himself didn't believe were true, and then again brought it up a year later when it was unnecessary. So that was the primary thing. It wasn't anything specific on the ball field. In fact, in that series, Christy Mathewson had pitched great, but he lost two games. He had an earned run average of under one and still lost two games. So Wood didn't have any grudge against him for anything that had happened on the field. In fact, Mathewson lost that last game when the Red Sox got a sacrifice fly, and Wood was the winner over Mathewson. But it was an issue about rumors that Mathewson repeated, and Wood felt he didn't need to do that.
Few players have been able to reinvent themselves after an injury the way Wood did, when he had what was probably today we would know as a torn rotator cuff or some other kind of major surgery, needed major surgery on his shoulder. He became an outfielder, and he became a very good outfielder, and he became a much better hitter, and he became a good base runner. Can you think of anybody else that's really made that kind of transition from being really, really good at something and being awful good and in another position?
Not to the degree he did. I mean, his name gets brought up now with Ohtani, for example. Yeah. It was just brought up again a couple of weeks ago, because Wood was one of the few people, along with Ohtani and, of course, Babe Ruth, who struck out 500 batters and also got 500 hits. So, yeah, he had a very, very successful experience as a position player. And in that way, until Ohtani came along, he and Babe Ruth were really mentioned in the same breath as really the only guys who had been successful. And I think I'm glad we're talking about this, and I hope when people read the book, they'll see how good Wood was and how much of a team player he was. I mean, he had 298 as a position player, and most remarkably, in the 1921 season, well into September, Wood was hitting over 400, but he was playing as a platoon player with a guy named Elmer Smith, who was also having a couple of really great years. And it was one of the heroes of the 1920 World Series when the Indians won. By then, Wood was playing for the Indians. Tris Speaker had sort of brought him over after Wood's arm problems. And they tried to make him into a pitcher. But then he really was actually a utility player. He played first base. He played second base. And he primarily played left field. He eventually sort of settled in as a right fielder and platooned with Elmer Smith. But he had a really great career. What he always said was that he didn't take hitting that seriously when he was a pitcher.
Yeah.
So he did two things that to us seem really simple. One is he choked up farther so that he wouldn't strike out as much, and he used a more thick-handled bat, one like Joe Jackson had used, so that he could hit inside pitches better and still get enough on the ball to get it to the outfield. Actually, when he first moved to the outfield, he hit quite a few home runs, and a couple of times was even compared to Babe Ruth. And the question was, who's going to be the next great home run hitter after Ken Williams? Would it be Wood or Ruth? Now, Wood didn't become a home run hitter, but he certainly was a clutch hitter. And that's another thing that people need to understand, that Wood may not have played as much because there was Elmer Smith, but when he played and when he was in the clutch, he was a real cool customer. And at a very, very high RBI per hit average, right up there, even above Speakers and just below Ty Cobb. So by 1922, when they traded Elmer Smith, Wood was back playing regularly. And as a 32-year-old, he knocked in 92 RBIs, which actually was a record for a while. Of a last season for a player, how many RBIs that he had. So, yeah, he was really good, and he was also a utility player for a while and then sort of settled into the outfield.
Before we let you go, he ended up his career as the coach at Yale and gets an honorary doctorate, and probably the only person to get one of those from Yale who never went to college. Can you talk a little bit about that ceremony and what was behind it before we let you go?
Sure. Actually, Wood never graduated from high school,
right,
and got an honorary doctorate from Yale. He was a Yale baseball coach. Tris Speaker and some people in Cleveland got him an assistant job as a baseball coach, and within 1 year, he became the head baseball coach at Yale and was there for about 19 years. The ceremony is a really interesting drama in itself, because Bart Giamatti, who was a professor of comparative lit at Yale, knew a lot about Joe Wood, and his father worshipped Joe Wood. And they lived somewhat in the same neighborhood of Westville there in New Haven. And in the 1940s, when Yale wanted to cut back, one of the things they did was sort of consolidate their coaches. And they let Joe Wood go after 19 years. And Joe was very bitter about that. And it was well known in the area that Joe had bad feelings about that. Well, before he became commissioner of baseball, Bart Giamatti became the president of Yale. And through Joe's sons and through some other connections, like one of the secretaries at Yale, Bart knew about this problem. And partly to celebrate the life of Smokey Joe Wood, and partly to try to heal the wound. In January of 1985, they held a private ceremony to give Joe Wood the honorary doctorate. And it was only the second time in the history of Yale that a doctorate had been given someplace else other than on campus. And so Joe Wood by then was suffering with Alzheimer's disease. He wouldn't survive the year. And so my book begins with that story because it's a fascinating drama, if you have any sense of dramatic history, that Bart Giamatti was there as the president of Yale, trying to heal some wounds on the behalf of Yale. That Joe Wood was there with Alzheimer's, but part of the time in the ceremony, he sort of knew what was going on. His son Bob was there to sort of coach him. And it was a really interesting, dramatic event. One of the people who was there was Leo Cooney, a man who was taking care of Wood when he got old. And I got to talk to Leo about Dr. Cooney about that. And he's the one who, interestingly enough, told me that Joe's problem was a rotator cuff. That was an interesting story in itself. When I was with Dr. Cooney, I said, well, you were with Joe when he died. I don't know if it was professional courtesy or not, but did you look? And he said, yeah, I was a great Red Sox fan. And I looked, and yeah, it was a torn rotator cuff. It started out with a broken finger, But then, as we know, sometimes that leads to other kinds of problems. And eventually he got a torn rotator cuff. One of the other things that's amazing about Joe, just to throw that in, is the 1915 season, he was pitching with that torn rotator cuff. And even though he could only pitch about once every 3 weeks, he pitched all that he could. One time, won 9 games in a row, had an earned run average of 1.49 and a record of 15-5. So pitching with a torn rotator cuff, he led the American League in both winning percentage and ERA.
Well, it's a fascinating...
Somebody he could play through pain.
He sure could. It's a fascinating book. Well, thank you so much for making time, being with us. For our listeners, it's Smokey Joe Wood, The Biography of Baseball Legend by Gerald C. Wood. Gerald, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Great to have Gerald Wood back with us here on Downtown.